to my buddy's beer and joint. Here's the keys, joint.
Yo, I'm not driving. I'm way too stoned. How are you feeling, beer?
Oh, since we had that talk, I'm not driving tonight at all.
What about you, Dave?
You only had a couple of drinks.
And only a couple of puffs.
I don't drink and drive. No way I'm getting behind the wheel when I smoked weed, too.
How are we getting home, then?
Come on, Dave. Take one for the team.
Don't let weed and alcohol influence your decision to drive.
Yeah, I need a ride.
A message from Mad Canada.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Every listener matters, and we're here because of listeners like you. Thank you for all your support.
I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Victoria Radke will be telling us a little bit about the Canadian Association of Pompeii. So what can you tell me about the association?
So the Canadian Association of Pompeii is a nonprofit patient advocacy group that is dedicated to supporting families and patients with Pompeii disease in Canada.
So,
we were founded in 2006 by a group of families. At the time, there was only one treatment for Pompeii, and it wasn't approved in Canada. So the group kind of started as a way for those families to support each other. And then CAP, so Canadian Association of Pompeii, became a registered nonprofit in 2012 and currently has about 70 members across Canada.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, how does Pompeii typically affect a person?
Yeah, so Pompeii disease is a rare inherited neuromuscular disorder. It's caused by a deficiency of an enzyme called acid alpha glucosidase. Basically, it means that it allows the deficiency of this enzyme allows the buildup of glycogen in the cells. So this, without treatment, causes progressive muscle and organ deterioration. The effect is mostly on the lungs. The effect that's most concerning is on the lungs and the heart, but other symptoms include leg and abdomen weakness, difficulty walking, gastrointestinal issues, and difficulty eating.
So with the host of symptoms, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Absolutely. It can be diagnosed as more common disorders. It could be misdiagnosed as limb girdle dystrophy, which is another type of muscular dystrophy, Duchenne, ALS maybe. Often it goes unnoticed in late onset Pompeii. Patients who may not have symptoms appear until late into their adulthood, or at least not ones that are concerning. Patients often spend most of their lives unable to do certain things like doing sit-ups or whatever, but you know, if you're not a particularly active kid, or if you're functioning in a way you can still, you know, hang out, still play, still work, you might just feel like you are easily fatigued, which might not prompt you to go to a physician.
So How does the association reach out to those who could benefit from knowing more about this condition?
We are dedicated to creating educational content both for the larger community and then the medical community. For the larger community, you can go to our website. We have a lot of resources, including, you know, explaining what Pompe is, how it's treated, how it's diagnosed, clinical trials. For patients, our people who might be affected, we have what's called our Pompe How-To articles, which is specific topics that affect Pompe patients. So, for example, you know, how do I navigate like accessibility on planes, or how do I talk to my child's teacher about accommodation? How do I deal with grief? That kind of thing.
So, in your time with the association, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
So because I'm not a patient, and this is my first time in the patient advocacy space, it's not so much a success, but something that I'm incredibly, I feel incredibly privileged to be a part of. We work closely with other organizations, both like patient advocacy groups, other groups specifically helping Pompe patients, other groups that focus on related disorders, that kind of thing. And I've just been so proud to be in a community that helps each other so much. There's sort of this philosophy in the rare disease space where a success for one of us is a success for all of us. And so I've just been very welcomed by the community, and they have no problem answering questions or, you know, saying like, hey, I did this for a year and I learned all of the ways that that didn't work. So here's some advice. And it means that each group doesn't have to start from scratch. So I've just been really privileged to be able to be part of that.
Do you have any advice for folks out there who are just starting the journey and asking, can I successfully navigate this condition? Is there still hope for me?
Absolutely. So the first thing would be, first advice I would give you is to get in contact with myself or my co-worker, Brad Credenton. The information is on our website. I think the first step is just realizing you're not alone. Especially in Canada, it's so big and there aren't that many patients. I said there's only, you know, we only have 70 members. So the process can feel really isolating, and like the treatment for it takes a long time. It can impact your sort of daily life, the way that you schedule things. So, there's a big emotional weight that's put on patients, especially early on, and this sense of like being alone. And we really want patients to feel comfortable just talking to us. We will answer the phone at any time, answer emails at any time. It's probably our favorite part of the job is being able to just talk to our community. Brad is someone who has not only run this organization for over 10 years, but also is a patient himself and has been part of this process since, you know, before multiple therapies were approved. So he really knows the ins and outs of the approval process and what doctors to get contact with, and, you know, who's an expert and what resources you should seek out.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Ken Millen will be telling us a little bit about the Dakota Bipolar Awareness Foundation. So what can you tell me about your work with the bipolar community?
The Dakota Bipolar Foundation was started 5 years ago after the death of my daughter, Dakota. She was bipolar. She had all kinds of issues and struggles with it. Up until a short time before, I wasn't totally convinced it was bipolar. I was always hoping that it was something else. She was just not getting, you know, she was acting immature. She wasn't getting over it. As it turned out, it was bipolar, and she died in the end with fentanyl, you know, self-medication. So I formed the foundation, got some friends of mine, we helped put it together. And the foundation is here to help other families that are struggling with someone in their family with bipolar. It's a family disease. The whole family must get involved with this, not just the person that has it. Everybody needs to know. And if everybody had known in our family, I think we would have had a different outcome. But we just didn't. Part of us didn't want to believe it. We didn't want to. She was 30 years old. We just felt, you know, she was going to snap out of it one of these days. But that didn't happen.
So, how does the foundation reach out to families who could potentially benefit from knowing more about this condition?
Well, we have an excellent webpage, the DakotaFoundation.ca, and it has a host of information on it. We have some tremendous newsletters that are going out 3 times a month. We have 2,500 subscribers on that alone. We've had over 5,000 people on the website in the last 3 months, new people. So we're definitely getting traction for supplying information that people need. Our hope is to even have more on our webpage. As time goes on, we're going to put books that are going to be available for sale through Amazon that are recommended. What we did in the last little while, in May actually, we brought in 5 speakers from around Canada that were excellent on the subject of bipolar. We recorded it with 3 cameras. We got about a 4-hour program with 5 different speakers, and we'll be making that available to high school counselors, college counselors, university training programs. Canadian Mental Health has asked for it, the Canadian Mental Health Association. We'll put it on their Moodle across Canada. So our goal is to spread that information to thousands and thousands of counselors and clinicians across Canada. These are the latest up-to-date things that are happening with bipolar. 2 of them spoke on early detection, which is critical. The earlier you can detect bipolar, the better. And 2 of the sessions were on, there's one on specific on a new app that's going to be available for those with bipolar. There'll be actually 2 apps altogether. One's done in the States, is being done with AI, and one is going to be done in Canada. So these are 2 great features. They'll be done in the fall. That will assist people, and we want to make books available and just all around education to everybody on bipolar. We want to take the stigma out. It's not a bad thing. You get it, it's not your fault. You get it, it's not a choice. It's something you get, and it takes 3 things to be bipolar. You can read more about those things on our webpage and the information that we're supplying. So for those that are affected by bipolar, I would encourage you to check out our website, get a hold of the doctors, get more information and learn about it. There's good things on the web. A lot of people have had bipolar and had successful lives. You know, I was just going through the list this morning, you know, Mariah Carey, Mel Gibson, Britney Spears, Robert Downey Jr., Richard Dreyfuss, Charlie Sheen, we all know his antics, Selena Gomez. So there's a lot of people that have had bipolar, and they get stable through doctors and through counselors, proper medication, and they live. They get a life after.
So,
the earlier you can get stable, the better your life.
So, what are some of the biggest myths or misperceptions surrounding bipolar?
You know, there's 3 levels of bipolar. There's 1, which is cyclothemic. Then there's bipolar 2 and bipolar 1 rapid cycle. A myth is that you can be cured. Well, you can't. Not today. Hopefully one day. It's all you can do with bipolar is manage it properly. that's one myth that you can get through it. The other myth is a lot of people, you know, 3% of the population, there's different numbers, 2.5, 3%. But it happens and it's not a choice. And here's a really good thing. 70% of the people we see on the railways, on the streets, downtown, the large centers, the homeless, 70% had mental illness before they took their first drug. 30%, and I got this number from Canadian Mental Health, 30% actually get out of being homeless after a period of time. But the 70%, you know, they're self-medicating with very dangerous drugs and a lot of brain damage, and it's trouble. So the goal is to see if we can't help them before they get that far down the road.
So do you have any advice for folks out there who might be starting this journey on how you kept yourself strong in those moments of difficulty in establishing the foundation?
Well, you know, everybody, the grief was there. Well, it's still there. I deal with it on a daily basis of Dakota. I call her name up constantly throughout the day. It's like, but I would, if you do have someone in that's been partially diagnosed with bipolar, my advice is, get help. Start learning about this thing. Learn about what happens when they're in manic and what happens when they're in the depressed state. Because if the more you know about it, the more you can help that person. If you don't know anything about it, it's really hard. It's difficult. You're comparing them to a normal person all the time, and you're thinking it's their fault. Well, when the chemical balance kicks in, and they're in manic or depressive, you know, sometimes they don't know the consequences of their actions. They can make the same mistake several times in both manic and depressive. So that's a real hindrance for a person to have that. That's why stabilization is critical. Learn about bipolar. There's lots of things on the web. Go onto our website. There's YouTube's on there. Just that it's a very serious disease. People die from it. 1 in 4 with bipolar 1 will take their life. 1 in 4. It's a pretty high number. With bipolar 1 rapid cycle. So, you know, start learning about it. That's my suggestion. And the quicker you learn and the more you know, the more you can help the individual and your family. And it's a family problem. It's not just that person's.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, you can.
To find out more or to make a donation, visit dakotafoundation.ca. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Victoria Ratk told us a little bit about her Pompeii work, and we heard about the Dakota Foundation from Ken Millen. This next segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened.
In this segment of our show, John Aslin will be giving us an update on Rose City Riot. So what's the latest with Rose City Riot?
Well, we are currently preparing for the upcoming season starting in September. Starting to put in our requests for our gym time.
So tell me a little bit about how you keep active during the summer and how you encourage your players to do the same.
A lot of our athletes are multi-sport athletes. So in the summer, they have different sports that they participate in. A few of them play volleyball, soccer, things of that nature. Personally, I like to spend a lot of time in the water. My wife and I do a lot of kayaking, so that's how I try to stay active through the summer, is by kayaking.
So when you kayak, do you use any modified equipment or go through any specialized training?
No, I am fortunate enough with my disability that I don't actually need any special equipment. Of course, I have all the necessary equipment. And really, it just comes down to finding the right place to launch. As long as I can get close enough to the water with my wheelchair, then I can get it.
So, what were some of the high points this past season for the team?
We had a couple of good moments, actually, and I'd say they're more individual high points for some of our athletes. So two of our athletes went out to Alberta this year to compete in the, I think it was the CWBL Nationals tournament. that took place. And then another one of her athletes, Celine, she plays for Women's Team Ontario. So she went out to BC for that tournament, where the Women's Team Ontario got a bronze medal this year.
So in that sense, when the team travels, do you find the venues offered in other areas are typically accessible?
Yeah, anytime that we're traveling, because of the hosts, they're usually their own venues where we're going to, so accessibility has never really been an issue. I think, generally speaking, one of the biggest concerns that we have, at least for the wheelchair users, is at the hotel. Carpeted floors really suck for wheelchair users when they have to push themselves all the way down a long hall to get to their room and carrying their luggage at the same time.
So, can you offer any sort of solution for that? Something the players might have found a practical way of getting that done?
Well, there are different devices out there now, different sort of like power add-ons that you can have on your wheelchairs. One is called the Companion or the Smart Drive, a lot of people have. Those types of devices are very handy in those types of situations, but not everybody has one of those. What I've also noticed is that there's also some luggage that is a little bit more wheelchair-friendly, where you can just kind of hook it on the back of your seat or your backrest and actually just kind of pull it along with you instead of having to actually have it in your hands.
It sounds like an excellent idea.
Mm-hmm.
So what would the ideal outcome be for the season ahead? What do you hope to achieve?
The season ahead, we want to continue pushing with our training. We had a wonderful season last year with the training that we were doing, our skills development stuff. We're also looking forward towards the Ontario Parasport Games. Those are going to be taking place in 2027. We don't have a date announced yet, but the municipality of Brantford is the host for these events. So without knowing the exact format that wheelchair basketball is going to be held in, we're hoping that it'll be a team format where we can actually go out as a team this year.
So for those who might have missed our prior interviews, what are some of the key benefits of wheelchair basketball?
For me, the biggest one is community. You are surrounded by like-minded individuals, both with and without disabilities, that just want to engage in sport. And the camaraderie that goes along with that is just unmatched, I think, anywhere else that I've ever been a part of. So that's probably the biggest one. The other thing is just being able to get out and enjoy yourself without having to really worry about any barriers. We provide all of the necessary equipment that you might need to play wheelchair basketball, so really you just have to get yourself to the court and we can take care of everything else.
So I've heard many times that for someone with an acquired disability, especially an acquired injury, that being a part of sport gives them something to sort of keep them active, sort of that focal point of finding strength in their new set of circumstances. You ever found that to be the case?
Yes. I've provided or done a lot of peer support over the years with amputees, and I'll say I'm fortunate because my disability was a result of a birth defect, so I've lived my life like this. I haven't had to have a life-altering moment like many others have. So for those that have an acquired disability, it can be very challenging to get over the mindset of, like, what am I going to do with my life now? It's completely different than what I'm used to. So being able to participate in parasport allows people to see that there is still potential for fun, for sport, for strength development. There's just an unnamed amount of benefits that those with acquired disabilities and those with lifelong disabilities can really benefit from.
So I'd imagine you try and meet people where they are in terms of their abilities, take what they can do and sort of take it a step at a time, just see how far they can push themselves.
Yeah, and a lot of the times what happens is as humans, we create these barriers in our minds that we believe that for whatever reason, we can't actually do what it is that is in front of us. But until we break out of that mindset and actually just try to do this, it's just like one step at a time. But once you take that first step, and you realize, like, yeah, this is actually possible, then the excitement just, you know, swamps you, and you just want more.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again, Jim. Pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure as always.
My friends, I must say I'm deeply moved by Ken's story. But the truth of the matter is, a person can look fine on the surface, be dealing with all sorts of things that we just don't see. The fact is, we have to keep an open mind. Someone says they have a disability, even if it's one we can't readily quantify, we have to keep our minds open. We have to be that source of support. Truth is, the deepest scars are sometimes the ones we just don't know about. I'll be honest, I have no idea where all this stigma surrounding mental health concerns comes from. Is it easier for us as a people to accept a disability we can readily see or process, something that's a household name? Sure, might be easier, but having something inside is no less valid. And it's no less of a struggle and a journey toward acceptance, both from oneself and from the world around us. The more we're ready to be someone who listens, the more we're willing to keep an open mind, the more progress can be made to support those folks who just want to be included. Yes, it's very true that society expects certain things from us. Someone asks how you are, they don't necessarily want to know the real answer, so people just say, I'm doing fine. But if we go deeper than that, someone's willing to be honest, maybe the person listening can do something to help them. Maybe they can be a gift to one another, help each other through the hard times. And yeah, everyone expects us to be happy-go-lucky all the time. Everyone expects us to put on this brave front, even if it's not honest. And society has lost a certain authenticity, I think. Maybe true, you can't know another person's struggles or another person's journey in its entirety. It doesn't mean you should just give a quick, pablum, superficial answer and send a person on their way. Someone's really hurting or really needs to talk. Be there. It's better than the alternative by a mile. That being said, the compromise is your own emotional well-being or your own mental health. Might be time to take a second look. But if there's something you can do in being a source of support, it's our obligation to one another as a people to try. Tragic circumstances need not happen. If all it takes is someone being willing to lend a little compassion, a little understanding, and to look beyond the surface. Someone says, I'm fine, and then takes off and sits alone, socially isolates. It could be a warning sign. And, yeah, you can't know every warning sign out there, but you can at least try. Someone will be more likely to reach out if you are more likely to reach in. And maybe you can't solve all the problems of the world, but you can do a little bit. And if each one of us working together puts forth that effort to understand mental health concerns, to understand that there's more to disability life than just what we see on the surface, we'll all be that much farther ahead. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you for your constant support. You help keep independent community radio alive.
Cheese, please, yes. Cheese, please, you're so fine.